Yeah, that's so like you.
I know.
It's so like you to cause trouble and with our rabbit trails.
So chatty over there.
Jerry, did you take over his body or something?
Are you familiar with an ESB Bible?
Uh huh. Extra English? Special version.
English
Standard Version. English.
Huh? Our pastor said he's switching over to it because something about Zondervan is printing a gender neutral Bible now.
Yeah. Right.
New International Version. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So
right.
The nearly expired version. Switching over to the ESV for that reason.
Yeah, that's good. I think it's a good thing.
Oh, okay.
You know about Chris?
Yeah.
That's Chris, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so I think it was in 84 when the first NIV came out. And that was the Bible I had to start with, you know. And it's a good translation, I think. But what's happened, though, is as they've moved forward, they've updated it a couple times. And it's moving. There's a liberal agenda that's behind the translation. And so where it started wasn't really all that problematic. It wasn't like what you'd call a real formal translation. It was a little bit looser with ideas. Yeah. So there were places where...
Word for word, it's
more thought for thought. I mean, they have all different terms they use for these things. But basically, it tried to convey what the translator thought was being said, as opposed to sticking with the words and letting you wrestle with places where it could mean this, it could mean that.
Right.
So, like, in a place where it might say it's good not to touch a woman, it would say something like it's good not to be married, or I can't remember all the, but I have examples in my notes. But so it was an okay translation, and it was I think it still is the most popular translation today as far as sales numbers go. So if you go into Bible bookstore, you'll see the NIV is the biggest marketing one that you'll see that's up there. But so what's happened is they're moving in a direction where they are taking masculine Greek words and translating them in a way where they're no longer masculine, and so basically trying to make it more explicit that these words include women as well. So when it says brethren, that's too masculine, right? So it's a politically correct kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of sticking with what the words say. Obviously, brethren mean women as well,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Men and women in the congregation. I mean, if it's addressed that kind of way. But some people aren't happy unless it, explicitly promotes gender neutrality.
Well, in my word, it says husband treat your wives. So.
I think it still sticks with that.
I mean,
yeah.
Even
yeah. Yeah. I think it'll stick with that. But
treat your spouse.
Yeah.
It's just trying to. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't. I haven't.
Yeah.
I used to follow the different translations a lot more closely, but I haven't really looked at what's going on lately because it's gotten so ridiculous. It's just kind of like, what's the point? But the ESV is a really good translation. And it's I've just been reading a book on Bible translations, and the guy, there's like four or five different guys discussing issues of Bible translation, and each of them is from the committee of a major translation, one of the major translations that are fairly modern. And the guy who's the most conservative of those, who I think he has the right ideas and principles, is from the ESV. So my only complaint with ESV, which is extremely minor, is they don't use italics in places where they've added phrase, some other words around the phrase to make it read more clearly in the English. So in cases where you're really, wanting to push and look at a subtlety, you don't have that little tip that, this part isn't actually in the Greek, right? It's added in the translation to make it read in the English more smoothly. In most places it doesn't cause a problem, but it's something I'm just kind of used to having because the King James kind of started that off, and it's been done in the NASB and the New King James.
Does gender neutral mean taking father and making it not father anymore? Like, for that push too, right?
Yeah, I think
like
there
the
are
the male part of God.
Yeah, I think there are places. Again, I'm rusty on it because I haven't looked at what they're doing with this latest version. But the direction it's headed is the direction that some of the seminaries have gone to, like at Princeton, where they don't pray to Father God anymore. It's a, you know, it's a gender neutral idea of God, right? So you have this whole idea where people are just moving away from the male aspect of how the scripture is written.
What they're trying to do is bring their Bible up to what the world's doing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because that's what's happening in the whole world, actually.
Right.
Is general gender neutrality.
Right. Yeah. So I
teach it in grade school.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to look in my notes. I might have some examples from articles I've read, but it's this idea that women are not coming to, you know, the idea that women don't like Christianity because it's so what's the right word? I'm thinking of, I can't think of the right word. Chauvinistic. Yeah. And so
that Muslims are.
Yeah. And then there's, you know, there's, and I don't know, I haven't looked at this particular, I haven't looked at that particular translation to know if it does it, but there have been people that have taken, where it talks about a woman is not to be an authority over a man, right?
Oh.
There have been people who've translated it, that in a way where it implies that it's not saying a woman isn't to be an authority, it's implying that a woman isn't to take authority from a man. But a woman can be an authority as long as she doesn't take it from a man. You see what I'm saying? It's like the homosexual deal, right?
She can beat you in arm wrestling.
No, I'm talking about so people wanna take the general principle that applies across the board and they wanna narrow it down to a narrow situation, and then their situation isn't that situation,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same thing as what you see with the gays as well, right? They're going to want to teach the Bible is against unloving relationships, right, as opposed to the practice of homosexuality. And so they would try to contextualize the passages on homosexuality and say, well, back then, homosexuals weren't treating each other well, you know, and so
yeah.
That's why...
That's what they do with the with the woman thing too. They try to make it to what was happening back at that time.
Right.
Try to say, well, this is going on,
and that
so
church,
all
yeah.
had to say that because
mm-hmm.
women were being
mm-hmm.
too forceful in church or whatever.
The
wives.
So there's a lot of stuff goes on with that. So I presume he's saying that because there's probably quite a few people that are using the same translation.
Didn't you refer to that? Newer members would buy the new version.
Right.
You find that.
Mm-hmm. So they're going to change it to the
WHN?
Yes,
oh, I know. I was just saying this. WHN, what's happening now, Bible?
Oh.
Yeah. Try to make it more user-friendly.
Yeah. One nice thing about the ESV, too, is that each of these translations has a company behind it or a foundation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like behind the NSB is the Lockman Foundation, and ESV is Crossway Bibles, and HCSB is Holman. So the ESV is by Crossway, and Crossway has, I think, one of the highest quality, really nice, different variety of forms and formats that comes in, and they offer it free too in a lot of different formats, completely free. So I think they're doing a really nice job. People like to journal. They have these beautiful journal versions of the ESV. You know, they're just like a work of art. If you look at how it's bound and the covers and everything's really nice. So, you know, other than the fact that I have a digital Bible, I would, you know, salivate over the ESV. But
how about this one?
That's Thomas Nelson, right?
This is really...
Yeah, really nice.
Really nice.
Yeah, in fact, it's frustrated me because I use the New King James, right? And Thomas Nelson has done a lousy job for dozens of years with their Bible printing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I finally took kind of a halfway crummy binding and shipped it off and got it custom bound somewhere else to get a good one, because I couldn't find one I liked anywhere. So now I don't even use it because I'm using it. So yeah. So did you have any other questions
about
it? No,
I was just curious about that. Never heard of any ESV.
Uh huh. Yeah. Mhm.
I do have one thing for you.
Yeah.
I can't lose my.
Just one.
You broke the ice.
I let it out, didn't I? You know, last week when I met, I was trying to think of something where it said that man presents his wife to Jesus. Well, that's not in the Bible, so I apologize for that.
Thanks, Jerry.
I did try to look it up, because I think it's just something that was said, and you kind of absorb it, you know, and you think it's part of the Bible. But that's basically it.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's great. I mean, it's not great. It wasn't in the Bible, but it's great that you want to make sure that we're not confused about it. Yeah. Well, you remember a lot of other things that are in there too. So, whatever, you know. Okay, so got a couple of rabbits on the way there, I guess. So I wanted to read the first four verses again of chapter 11. We talked quite a bit about it, but there's a little bit more I wanted to talk about that's a related passage. So, 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 1. Oh, that you would bear with me in a little folly, and indeed you do bear with me. For I am jealous for you with godly jealousy. For I have betrothed you to one husband, that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Christ. But I fear lest somehow, as the serpent deceived Eve by her craftiness... by his craftiness... So your minds may be corrupted from the simplicity that is in Christ. For if he who comes preaches another Jesus whom we have not preached, or if you receive a different spirit which you have not received, or a different gospel which you have not accepted, you may well put up with it. So we talked a little bit about this idea of other gospels, other spirits, you know, other Jesus. That whole issue. And so what I wanted to do a little bit today is to look at a parallel passage where he talks about the same idea in Galatians. This would be in the first chapter of Galatians, because I think there's some interesting insights that can be gained from looking at this other passage about just what he means by another gospel. So, Kathy, are you there?
Sure, yep.
Can you read verses 6 through 9 for us?
Sure.
Okay.
Galatians chapter 1. I marvel that you are turning away so soon from him who called you in the grace of Christ to a different gospel, which is not another, but there are some who trouble you and want to pervert the gospel of Christ. But even if we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel to you than what we have preached to you, let him be accursed. As we have said before, so now I say again, if anyone preaches any other gospel to you than what you have received, let him be accursed.
Okay. So you have the same idea here of a different gospel. So if some of you are familiar with the book of Galatians, what was one of the main issues that Paul's concerned about in this book?
Grace versus law.
Okay, grace versus law. And in specific, what is the main issue that's disturbing him that's going on in Galatia? What's the law aspect that he's concerned about?
Works,
okay. But what is it that...
Circumcision.
Okay. So there are people there, Jews, Christians who are Jews, that are saying that the Galatians have to do something besides believe on Christ.
Mm-hmm.
They have to keep aspects of the Mosaic Law, in particular issue that comes up is issue of circumcision. So when you read through this and you listen to the ideas, one of the things that can strike you in the book of Galatians is just how severe Paul is about this. And he gets in chapter 3, in the very first verse, he says, "O foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you that you should not obey the truth?" So you can see he's like, this is not like a subtle thing to him. And so one of the insights I think you get from looking at this passage is that it doesn't take very much to turn the gospel into another gospel, which is not another. In other words, it's another gospel that isn't really a gospel.
Yeah.
It's another, quote, good news, but it's bad news.
Mm-hmm.
and in this particular case, all they're saying, quote, all they're saying is, well, you believe in Christ, that's good, but what, you know, there's all this Old Testament law that God gave, and it's good, and the law is perfect, and all that, and let's just take a little piece of that, just one of, you know, one of a lot of things, a little, you know, it's not a little from a guy's point of view, but it is a small thing compared to the size of the law. Let's just bring this circumcision in, too. And from Paul's perspective, just that little addition completely destroys the accuracy and the truth of the gospel, so much so that he calls it another gospel. And he says that people that promote that should be accursed, anathema, is the word, you know, basically separated from God's blessings.
That's why they had the Jerusalem Council too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they were trying to force Paul and Barnabas to teach actually Moses' law and circumcision.
Yeah, so there's this whole issue where sometimes we, you know, when we talked before about, you know, Mormons, right? And when you kind of boil it down, they use similar language and all that, but when you boil down to it, Jesus isn't divine. He's not God. And that is a pretty big deal, and it's pretty obvious that's a big deal.
Yeah.
This is way more subtle than that.
Yeah.
Right? So you wouldn't necessarily put this in the category of things that we obviously see today and we go, oh, that's just another gospel, because it's so far afield, like Mormonism. And I would say Roman Catholicism that way too, the whole idea there.
Or would it be also where it would be you believe in the cross and what he did on the cross, but to be saved, you got to be baptized.
Yeah.
That, to me, is subtle now. Because it's all right there, and you're supposed to be baptized, but when you punch it over to where it's equal to what Jesus did on the cross, then you come into another gospel.
Yeah, because like Church of Christ,
right?
You know, you have to be baptized before they recognize you as being saved.
Or you have to be baptized in their church too.
Exactly.
That's another thing.
Right.
You have to go to the correct church to be baptized.
Right.
So
when you look at the things that motivate Paul or agitate Paul, I guess is another way to put it, if you look at some of the subtleties about that Paul gets really agitated about, they're remarkably subtle sometimes, but they're only subtle in appearance when you first kind of read about them or think about them, because the more you study the scripture and the more you understand how the different concepts all fit together into a like a woven deal, when one thread gets pulled, the whole thing starts to unravel. And so Paul knows that the message of grace and the work of the cross it doesn't take much distortion before that is perverted in a way where the essential aspect of it gets greatly compromised, right? And I think he says, those who seek to be justified by the law have become estranged from Christ. He says that, I think that's in the verse, chapter 5, I think somewhere he says that. So it's in chapter 5, verse 4. In first chapter 5, verse 1, he says, "Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty by which Christ has made us free, and do not be entangled again with the yoke of bondage." In other words, go back under this performance-based salvation. And when he gets to verse 4, "You've become estranged from Christ, you who attempt to be justified by the law. You have fallen from grace." You have fallen from grace, because the minute you add a requirement on the grace, it's not grace anymore. It's something else.
You know, a few years back I read through the, Seventh-day Adventists, when they list their doctrinal statements, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was just really solid all the way through 11, 12. All of a sudden, as I remember, it got down to about 18 things that we would support, absolutely support. It might have been a copy from our church. All of a sudden, then it just flips there. They introduced Ellen G. White and keeping the Sabbath and all the food things and drinking, and and so they end up contradicting themselves by adding. But I don't recall if they said that's a requirement for salvation. It's just, this is what you should do.
Mm-hmm.
Which is different.
Right, it is. Yeah.
But still dangerous, because Peter's not saying this is required for salvation, right? In Galatians,
well, they were, yeah.
Oh, they were.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
When I look at it, when a man has his hand in anything like that, you have, guess what, inferior, stepping over into perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as that, although you can't, but in a sense, when you step over and have a part in salvation, you basically mud up the salvation part. Because even, I go back to even I think it was Leviticus, and where they got all the laws, when God set up even the, he consecrated everything to a certain degree where man just gets their hands off of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they touched it in a wrong manner, it was contaminated.
Right.
And that's how I see that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's good.
Right.
And one thing is, if you add anything, any work at all, what you're saying is that what Jesus did was not enough. And I think that's the key thing there, is that his work was final and total.
Mm-hmm.
And in anything you try to add to it, then what you're doing is diminishing what he did on the cross. Mm-hmm. And so that, I think, is a key thing to think about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's, these are the reasons. So, I had a conversation a while back with David Ridge, David who comes here. He was asking me about some things involving different churches that he's attended and stuff. And one of the things he talked about was, it just seems like the churches are divided on these subtleties, and so one of the things I was talking to him about was, as Christians, what we need to be able to understand is not just what are subtleties, but which are critical subtleties and which are not.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because you can be in a fellowship where, like, Seventh Day would fall in this category, I think, where they're not questioning your salvation, but they're recommending things, or, there's an aspect of what we would feel is legalistic in their approach to certain things, and that are hard to justify from the New Testament, But then there's other groups where it clearly crosses the line. And so that's one of the things that you want to be able to know the scriptures well enough to know what is a subtlety and what isn't a subtlety. And then also in areas where it's not a subtlety, as you gain more experience as a Christian, you come to a better understanding of when people have beliefs that really don't line up in their secondary or tertiary even, but they don't really line up with what Scripture says, there's still fallout that comes from that.
Mm-hmm.
And so in Ephesians, it talks about this business of coming to the unity of the faith. In fact, I think Greg shared on that on Sunday. But when it says, until we come to the unity, you can read that in another way, to which is saying, right now there's disunity. Until we mature, there's disunity. And so Paul in that passage is saying that there are going to be differences between Christians over some of these issues, and we can expect that. But he's not treating that the same. He's saying that's a maturing process where the way we come to unity is through the knowledge of the truth. And since we don't have uniform knowledge of the truth, we don't have that unity. But he's treating that a lot different than here, where he's saying, you know, let them be accursed. There he would say, well, we're at various stages of sanctification and growth, and there's grace for that. I mean, that's to be expected, because we're not all on the same page, you know. But when it comes to these issues, that's where he kind of lowers the boom there, and he's, you know, he'll say things in other places, you know, that if you shouldn't be in a fellowship like that. You shouldn't be fellowshipping with people who are promoting those distorted gospels.
So you wouldn't necessarily say that, like, the Seventh-day Adventists are preaching another gospel necessarily. They're just...
Well, there's been a big debate about that, right?
Yeah.
And one of the people who I think I've had a lot of regard for, he's dead now, but Walter Martin was an expert on cults. And he reached the conclusion that the Seventh-day Adventists, he didn't consider them a cult. You know, so that's good enough for me. I'm not that familiar with all the subtleties. I've listened to them. They have a radio station in Port Townsend. You can get here really well. And when I'm in the shop, sometimes I'll listen to it. It's the same sort of thing. You'll hear some, you go, wow, that's great teaching, really solid.
Yeah.
And then the next thing that comes on is like, whoa.
So in my mind, I don't think I'm doing that.
So there's more to it than just meeting on Saturday.
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so, you know, if you get like books like Kingdom of the Cults, or there's four or five. If you look in there, you'll see they deal with some of those, and there are disagreements among Christians about whether they cross the line or not.
Yeah.
But he was a pretty knowledgeable guy on cults, and I think had a pretty solid grasp of the scriptures, and it was his feeling that, no, they weren't. He wouldn't call them a cult. So, but anyway, where it comes down to, certain words you have to be really careful when you use them. Like when you say heresy, the H word, you don't want to just be throwing that word around, because it basically means to be a heretic and to teach heresy. You have to be in this anathema group. You know, you have to be in this group that, from Paul's point of view, you're not going to heaven because you're teaching something that's a distortion of the truth that's really important to God. So you have to be outside of orthodoxy. You can't just be someone that has a view that you think is weird. It has to be unbiblical to the point where it undermines an essential...
Like a virgin birth. You could distort that.
Right. So when you...
But that can be somewhat subjective, right?
It can be somewhat, because...
Because where things eventually go, like
Women
pastors being able to, you know, in the homosexual movement,
right
now they might still say that salvation is strictly of the Lord, you know, but talk 25 years from now, they might have added that acceptance of homosexuality as... as part of yourself. I don't know.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah. But who knows where they'll go with that? But yeah, that's a good example.
It can move into something that ultimately ends up in heresy.
Yeah.
Right now, it isn't necessarily. You know,
that's right.
Maybe.
Right. So as people drift, it's never stable.
Yeah.
So it's moving somewhere.
Yeah.
Right. So, but so when you use the word cult or you use the word heresy, you're basically saying their teaching is outside of the pale of orthodoxy. It's unorthodox. And unorthodox, when in a Christian realm, unorthodox doesn't mean just unusual.
Yeah.
It means it's heretical.
It's unscriptural.
Well, there's a lot of stuff that's unscriptural. Yeah. Heretical stuff's unscriptural, but there's a lot of other stuff that's unscriptural that isn't heretical.
Right.
Right. Like teaching that gay marriage is not heretical. I wouldn't call that a heresy.
Yeah.
It's not undermining the gospel. I think it's a severe distortion of what the Bible teaches. Yeah.
You're not talking sanctification.
Yeah. For instance, I think there could be situations where people have incorrect views on some fairly big things in the Bible, and they're still going to wind up in heaven because God's a graceful God.
That's right.
And all of us have things that are wrong in our understanding.
The subject of gay marriage, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, marriage, if it's through the state, okay, if you're married with not a pastor, under God, who cares who you are and get married, right? It doesn't make any difference. I mean, it doesn't affect anything. It goes against God's stated
design.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it doesn't mean a thing because if they're not married under God, they get legal rights, you know, awarded to them by the state.
Right.
And so, you know, it's in my mind anyway. If they get married, and I say this because I want your opinion on it. If a person gets married by the state, by a justice of the peace or whatever, and it's two women or two men, that's your business. I don't care. You guys are doing what is not, you're not right in God's eyes anyway. You're not, and we're not supposed to. The Bible tells us not to judge unbelievers because they're judged already.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole thing is, why do we make such a big deal out of this? I mean, it's like the more opposition you throw at something, the stiffer the opposition becomes, you know, to you. And it doesn't matter. In God's eyes, they're already damned to hell unless they repent and believe in Jesus Christ,
mm-hmm.
And so and what he did. So I'm not so sure that what's being done is justified. I mean, should we do that? I mean, is that what a Christian's supposed to do? Is go out and look for every little thing that's being done by the world that goes against what God says and pick it and be an agitator.
Well, okay.
I don't see that, and I just wonder what I mean. We're supposed to stand for what God says and does,
right.
And we can proclaim the truth.
Right.
But we're not. In fact, we're supposed to proclaim the truth. But as far as going out and picking on things that the world's doing, everything they do is bound for hell anyway. So it doesn't matter, you know.
Well, yeah. So I guess the thing is, when you look at those issues, I think there's some subtleties, though. You know, like that's not our focus for sure, but we are salt and light, and if we're salt and light, we're not salt and light to ourselves, we're salt and light to the culture. So there is this issue where we're called to be a light on a hill, salt and light, you can go back and you can see people like John the Baptist. How did he get killed? Well, he's meddling in the affairs of a non-believer, right? Herod. So you know, I'm not so sure that you can say that, well, as Christians, we just stay out of a godless culture and don't confront it. So there's the issue where it's definitely our focus should be on personal salvation and redemption, getting people to a point where they are understanding that they're separated from God and living in a way that's godless. But to the degree we focus in on one sin and make it this huge thing.
No, I don't mean just one sin. I mean the totality of what a non-believer
No, I know.
Does.
But
you
I'm
know,
saying,
a,
I think
that... I mean, this God will lead the person to, you know, the steps that are going to get him saved. And to just go out and condemn just a blanket condemnation, I don't think accomplishes anything except for more agitation.
Well, I would say that the church is not going out and condemning. What's happening is that homosexuals are cramming and ramming their views into the church.
They're compelling us to do something.
They're pushing their stuff down our throat, and they're telling us how we get to live as a church. So I don't see the church going out condemning homosexuals personally. I see homosexuals not allowing us to have a different view, even though we're not wanting to condemn them. We're just wanting to have a different view and express it.
Yeah, well, it depends, too. I mean, what you're saying doesn't apply to everything.
No.
And everybody.
Well, it's kind of like saying, too, the United States shouldn't get involved in the world. Now, why are we getting involved overseas? Because it might end up on our shores.
Well,
we
because there are drastic injustices done overseas that a righteous person would want to stop.
Right.
Like raising, like two homosexuals raising a boy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or
that falls in that category.
Or like
too.
A Muslim going out and cutting off some Christian's head. Now, that's kind of radical, and that's an injustice that we want to stop.
Right. But some people see that same thing for, you know, if you have a child that's going to be adopted into a homosexual couple.
Well, there is a problem with that, too, how a child can't make a determination on their own because they're being taught.
Right.
And so there's a difference there. There's something else. It's too bad.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm saying is I think that I'm not sure it's a black and white issue. I think that there are legitimate concerns about the homosexual agenda. It's not just homosexuality, it's a homosexual agenda. And I think many people can see where it's going, and they see it as a frog in the boiling pot issue that, you know, if we don't start pointing some of these things out, then we're going to be increasingly pushed with our backs against the wall.
And if like Canada, if you preach what the Bible says, you get thrown in jail.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
That's something
that might happen.
Concerned
sure.
With.
Yeah.
For
yeah.
Sure.
But I think, you know, I think to the degree the church is portrayed or portrays itself as all we're out there trying to do is to find people who live differently than the Bible and to condemn them, and, you know, that's definitely not the heart of Jesus by any means. But at the same time, the idea, you know, if we isolate ourselves to the degree that all we're concerned about is in the church and nothing outside, then I don't see how we can be salt and light, really, in a way that points out to the culture. You know, people have to know they're lost. And if they believe that, well, as long as I have a loving relationship, God accepts me, if nobody's there to tell them, well, no, he doesn't, then they're missing, you know, a partial motivation, the fear of God, you know, to turn around. It'd be like if we said, well, let's not preach about hell because, you know, it's a negative thing, and these people, so there's a part of the function of the church is to be the voice of the Holy Spirit, in a sense, and to say, you know, these things you're doing are not according to God. But to try to do that in a way that's intelligent, compassionate, loving, you know.
But the Holy Spirit's already done all of that, and they already know it according to the Bible. So it's how far
we'll take. The only thought I had was that I agree. It's not the church's job to go seek out every injustice and yell about it, but the thing about the homosexual movement is the contemporary church is notorious for wanting to please the culture and invite the culture in. And so when that is on the rise, it's no wonder it's on the rise in the church. So, you know, you can say, I'm kind of more like you, you know, I'm not really politically bent, I'm not an activist or anything, and I keep my blinders on to what God has me doing, rightly or wrongly, that's kind of what I do. So I tend to not, you know, yeah, well, that's no surprise, you know. But on the other hand, there's a gift for those people to say the truth, because it's going to end up in the church. It just is, you know. That's just another thought.
Some evangelists, some preachers, you know, we're not all the same.
Right. But just to say blanketly, the church shouldn't be involved in pointing those things out.
Well, I never said that, because we basically, with our teaching and the associations that we have, and people that ask us, and there's several ways that the word gets out. It's not going up and getting in somebody's face, you know.
Is that happening? That's how little I know about current affairs.
Yeah, I don't
know
either.
Are there a lot of Christian activists out there screaming at people?
It's mainly the worldly people trying to push these things onto the church.
Yeah.
That's mainly what it is.
Right.
And force things through the church.
Right.
Like we have to keep saying in Sunday school here, Greg and I, for the last year or a year and a half, you know, it's not like we want to talk about homosexuality all the time,
but
we're getting forced to talk about it over and over and over, because it's getting rammed, crammed, and jammed on this freight train, and we'd rather talk about something else.
We just have to make up our mind what we believe and stick to it and not be swayed, and make sure that those, anybody that we can influence, we influence in the correct way.
Well, there's that verse about, you know, the enemy comes in like a flood, but the Spirit of the Lord raises up a standard against him.
Yeah.
And we have to be that standard.
Yeah.
So.
Well, if God's put it on your heart to be that standard.
Yeah.
Not everybody.
I mean, it might be just living your life with your neighbor next door who's doing things. Who knows?
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
You have to be necessary.
I think that's how it's primary.
I mean, it's just like standing up at the life changing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree on one thing, though. Where I jump the biggest is when it starts to come into church and it's welcomed into a church.
Sure.
That's when I become the loudest.
Yeah.
Outside this place, I go, that's not wrong. That's not right.
Mm-hmm.
But in the church, I'm going to be right in your face, because it's some place where it shouldn't be. And out there, you can say it's wrong, and then you can just walk away from it, because they're going to do what they do, but you said it's wrong, and I can show you why if you want.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the church, no, there's no room there. You've got to go right after their throat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so even in those situations where there's serious error like that, and it has to do more with social, political, cultural stuff than it does with an understanding of the Bible. It's not really a theological issue, it's a social issue, right? A moral issue, really. Those are important, but the things he's talking about, like a false gospel, you could have a church... You could have a church that's way offline on issues, some of these moral issues of the Bible, or authority issues with women or whatever, and they're still preaching the gospel.
Back in to the Jerusalem Council again, it says in there that believing Jews wanted to force them to have to teach circumcision and the Mosaic law. So these are people that were believers. So they were in the church.
Legitimate church members.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it'd be basically, maybe these two things in Galatians and there, maybe they're happening at the same time or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know when Paul and Barnabas were called down to Jerusalem.
Yeah. Most people think it was after the Galatians rejection.
So, just so I guess I'm clear, the determination of whether something is a false gospel is whether it, when it messes with the nature of salvation. Is that?
Yeah.
Right? Because there's
lots of false gospel. Yeah.
As
gospel.
Far as like what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Here.
I mean, there's other things, false views of God, but it's not the gospel.
Yes.
Right. The way of salvation.
The way of salvation.
The way of salvation gets impeded.
Right. So that's and kind of that's right.
Mm-hmm.
So just other thoughts and like we aren't necessarily a false gospel.
Yeah.
And, but actually, it would even be a sin, wouldn't it, to try to add something to what Jesus did?
Well, sure.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, any.
Yeah. I mean, no matter what it is, I mean,
yeah.
if you're trying to add something to it, then it's a sin.
Yeah.
Sure. Add to the words, that's also adding to the action.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Or subtract.
Right. Yeah. And so the measure of pickiness and subtlety that you pay attention to is directly proportional to how closely you're talking about a critical aspect of God's teaching, right? So all that to say that when you get near something that's really, really important, accuracy is more and more critical. Because it's almost like with weaponry, if you have a little squirt gun, you can shoot a lot of different directions. There's not that much damage. Somebody might get a little wet. But if you have like a bazooka, you want to make sure your aim is right, because if it's even a little off, there's a lot of side effect that comes from that. So that's the way it is with some of these core truths about what Jesus accomplished on the cross and how sufficient it was. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, the world looks out there and they go, well, how come, you know, you got the Catholics and the Protestants and they're at each other's throats all the time, and what's the big deal? You're all got this
religious
pomp and circumstance
yeah.
and religious stuff. They don't understand that at the core, when you shave away all that other stuff, the shape of the Pope's hat, how much money churches do have or don't have, whether they're doing social work, what part of the world they're in, how long of a historical stream they've been in, shave all that away and get down to what is the cross, what does it do in their system,
mm-hmm.
what do you have to do,
mm-hmm.
It's hugely different.
Mm-hmm.
And that difference, a lot of people have died for that difference, and they've died valuably for it. It hasn't been a waste of life. It hasn't
mm-hmm.
been a waste of spilled blood to fight for that. But you don't want to go out and spill your blood over things that aren't critical, right? So there's this whole issue of, you know, it goes all the way from arguing and separating, you know, to, you know, wars that people have about different things or whatever. You really want to be sure and understand what the issues are that are at stake and whether, you know, how important they are. You know, for Paul to go out and call this, you know, say that these people are cursed, you know, he's saying it's a really big deal.
So I'll bring it up again. So when the Pope said that the cross was a failure,
mm-hmm.
to me that was an affront to the gospel.
Political?
Yeah, it's
well,
hard to
say. That's not political. That's just a plain out
I,
and out.
How did he say that? I didn't hear that.
When he was speaking, he was having a, I think it was a mass. I can't remember, but I know it was a mass.
Yeah, okay.
And he said, spoke something, and then I was listening to it, and then I heard him. He said it was a cross is a failure.
It's insufficient.
Insufficient.
Yeah. And then I thought, I heard that, and then I started listening to other people and they heard the same thing. And I'm going, that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not all Catholics believe that. But when you get the leadership saying it, then that becomes a cult in my book.
Well, if you believe that Jesus has to die, you know, constantly, like they believe, then you have to believe that the cross wasn't sufficient.
Why do you think they take the literal body and blood of Christ every
day? Yeah, they say they have to have a priest that changes it into the Christ blood,
mm-hmm.
and
right.
you have Christ on the cross all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So,
So what we'll see, and this is a different topic as we get further along, but he's gonna bring up the point in Galatians 11. Sorry about that. 2 Corinthians 11. he's going to bring up the point that they put up with stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And when we get there, we could talk more about that. But that's one of the things that's a real problem in the church as well.
That reminds me of having Catholics that are saved and they're still hanging around in the church.
Right.
How can you do that? Unless you're still carnal, not taught. But once you're taught and you've been there, believing Catholic for years, you're still sitting there. You've got a problem with that.
Yeah.
So it comes down to our being saved.
Well, and what people's motives are. I mean,
Or because, my husband's going to stay there and he's not going to leave, or whatever, which is related to
him. Or maybe all your friends are there, There's all these things that people have, social reasons, right?
Yeah, I have troubles with it.
And he's even already hinting at that already when he says, you may well put up with it, in verse 4.
Okay.
Because he's going to bring this idea up several times that not only are these false messages and false teachings around, but the church doesn't really care. Or at least there's types of it where they don't understand, and other situations where they're not willing to react to it and separate, right? So there's a combination of things here. So anything more on the first four verses there where it talks about another Jesus, a false gospel? I just wanted to look at that Galatians passage because I think it points out, how something, it's not like yoga or something that's being brought in or something. It's like a little tiny piece of the Old Testament that's part of our religious writings from Judaism is just getting trotted up and joined into the cross.
Mm-hmm.
And that's enough that it flips Paul out. He's just like, this is anathema, accursed. It's not the gospel. So that's why I wanted to kind of look at that.
Mm-hmm.
In one aspect, I can see why Paul flipped out, because he came out of that. So he would be super sensitive to invoking that back in, if I was looking at it from a human stance.
Mm-hmm.
And we all have sore spots from the past, and we will not allow that to cross our path again.
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation. You have to believe that's part of why God chose Paul.
Because
as he'll say in this next little section, he's a Hebrew of Hebrews. Essentially, he's going to talk about all his religious qualifications in the law in the Old Testament. And that wasn't just an accident, like you're saying. God specifically chose Paul to write about the aspects of the church and grace, because he was entrenched as a Jew in Israel. And also, he was somebody who, he'll say, concerning the law, faultless, or, as good as you can get.
Mm-hmm.
So he was very, very sensitive to that whole idea because he had been involved with that himself, like you said. So does anyone want to read verses 5 through 12 for us?
I'll do that.
Okay.
For I consider that I am not at all inferior to the most eminent apostles. Even though I am untrained in speech, yet I am not in knowledge. But we have been thoroughly manifested among you in all things. Did I commit sin in humbling myself that you might be exalted because I preached the gospel of God to you free of charge? I robbed other churches, taking wages from them to minister to you. And when I was present with you and in need, I was a burden to no one, for what I lacked, the brethren who came from Macedonia supplied. And in everything I kept myself from being burdensome to you, and so I will keep myself. As the truth of Christ is in me, no one shall stop me from this boasting in the regions of Achaia. Why? Because I do not love you, God knows. Oh, but what I do, I will also continue to do, that I may cut off the opportunity from those who desire an opportunity to be regarded just as we were in the things of which they boast.
Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah.
So what's Paul trying to say in this section?
Similar to what he's been saying for a while.
Okay.
You know, that? Just that, he's saying that I'm not here to gain a profit. It's kind of what he's saying a little bit. He just keeps having to defend himself.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of what I see. He's still defending himself from accusations or something that's not expressly, you know, written in there.
So he's comparing himself and his time there against these other false guys. You know, like in verse 7, you get the impression that part of the reason that they didn't take him very seriously, didn't think much of him, is he didn't demand anything, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, it's like in the world of contracting, if you charge high wages, people think you're really good.
Yeah, absolutely.
The price is high on
or you appreciate something if you have to pay for it.
Yeah. And so you get the impression that some of these other guys were extracting fees, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they were more highly regarded because,
they're worth more.
They're worth more.
But I also see it when him not taking anything from them, he can say anything he needs to say.
Yeah, he's not.
And he doesn't, of course he would anyway, but I'm just saying, if you don't take anything from anybody, then you are not obligated to listen to somebody because, well, we did this and we gave that.
Yeah, so you're not stuck dependent on their income. So that of course comes down to the whole issue in our own day, if people come out of, like some people go to seminary and they rack up, you know, $100,000 in school fees, and then they go out and get a house with a mortgage, and then they're going to be a pastor and speak the truth no matter what in some little church. Well, maybe. I mean, if you really, you got to be pretty hardcore, but you've put yourself in a position where, man, you're gonna have some pressures if you have some people in your church that are big givers that don't like certain things you want to say.
Yeah, no.
You got your school to pay off and your house to pay off, and you know, so it
then where's
makes
your
it harder.
Faith, you know, faith in the congregation or in God. You know?
So here, I think he was primarily concerned with the appearance that. He didn't want anyone to be able to say that he was doing it for money.
Mm-hmm.
But it also does, like Sid says, it does have the advantage of putting him in a situation where he's not dependent on anyone either, and it's not even a chance of it, you know, kind of.
And if he ticks you off, well.
Yeah, it's not gonna soften what he has to say because he's not going to lose much that he doesn't already not have, right? But he mentions that, well, you know, this other church or brothers from Macedonia, right? The Macedonian churches were giving him funds to help him. Verse 9, when he was in need, for what I lacked, the brethren who came from Macedonia supplied, which is kind of what he was referring to earlier when he was talking about them with their giving, that other churches had been giving too and supporting him, and that he wasn't interested in their money for himself, but for them to be able to give to the Jerusalem church and the spiritual work that would do.
So that verse 8 where it says, I robbed other churches. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what it's referring to. It's not, he didn't really rob them, but he used those funds because they must have had excess to minister to this church.
Right.
Yeah.
And he says in several places, you know, he uses the word foolish, fool. And this whole thing is couched in tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
Where he's exaggerating and using words to provoke to point out kind of how ridiculous this whole thing is that he's even having to go here in this letter.
When I read that, I read that the money I took from them, they could have used in other ways, but they chose to let me have it, so I gave it to you. So basically, I robbed from the rich and gave to the the poor, kind of a Robin Hood thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and this is often a thing you see too with church, you know, new ministry situations where people go out and establish a new fellowship too. Is, you know, there's a lot of reasons why a beginning ministry wouldn't have the necessary support, and so the mother church helps that get going, helps them get on their feet. Part of it is when you go into a new area, there might not be any Christians at all to start with, for one. Mm-hmm. And then besides that, until believers become more mature and established in the faith, they're not necessarily going to be regular in directing some of their resources to the work of God. You know, so that's another issue there too. So you'll see a lot of churches that were started by kind of outreaches from other ministries. You know, Camino Chapel was that way, this way. This church was that way. American Missionary Fellowship was supported this church, and Village Missions was behind Camino Chapel, and a lot of other churches have been supported by Camino Chapel as part of Village Missions, where they basically find small rural works.
Well, yeah, the Sun McClary outline, and then the Marysville church spun off of the Stanwood Calvary Chapel.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So.
Right. So he's trying, so in verse 12 he's saying, you know, he's going to continue to do these things to cut off the opportunity from those who desire an opportunity to be regarded just as we are. So part, you can kind of read between the lines, part of what he's saying there is, you know, these other guys that you're listening to, they're not willing to do it in the same way I am. Right? They have other motives, is what he's getting at. They're after a hearing or being elevated or making some money or controlling you, or and he's going to go on a little bit later to talk about that they devour, you know, he talks about one devouring you or taking from you, exalting himself or strikes you in the face, and you just take it in. Right? So he's kind of saying, you know, these other guys are abusers, and you apparently like to be abused. That's mm-hmm. where he's going to go.
This is what he does. He does in love.
Mm-hmm.
First love.
Mm-hmm. So any thoughts on that little section before we push on? Yeah? Who wants to do 13 through 15, I guess?
I'll do it.
Okay.
For such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also transform themselves into ministers of righteousness, whose end will be according to their works.
Mm-hmm. That's a heavy verse for me. Every time I read that.
15 or the whole passage, those three verses?
Yeah. Well, 14 and 15.
Uh-huh.
Well, yeah.
So yeah.
Because, you know, just we, you know, you think of the Satan and his minions and the work, and then you think of it all because it's portrayed, you know, and the media is dark and, you know, all this, which it is. I'm not, but, you know, it's also beautiful, you know, like Mary says, beautiful deception, you know, and that's where it's scary. It's just so scary, you know, because don't know, it's very, it's just a heavy, because we think of it as, you know, and because those are easy to see. Oh, that's evil. That's dark. That's easy to stay away from. Yeah. Don't look at that. That's just dark. And, but this is something completely different.
It's like Satan uses just the littlest thing to get in, you know, have just a little deception, and then it can grow from there, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he calls them false apostles.
Yeah.
So the term apostle has this idea of being sent and being a representative. You're supposed to be representing someone. It'd be like an ambassador of state, you know, or somebody who's sent overseas that represents the country. So he's saying that these ones, you know, not only aren't they the original apostles, but they're not representing. They're not really representing who they claim to represent.
They're apostles of Satan.
Yeah. So they're saying we're sent by the Holy Spirit, we're sent by Jesus, but in reality, they're not. They're sent by a different deputy. They've been deputized by a different authority and sent out, spiritual authority, essentially. And so that not only is their origin not what it appears, but the way that they represent Jesus is also distorted in the gospel. And that's why, like it says, deceitful workers.
And then back in verse 3, it talks about how this serpent deceived Eve. And I wonder if that got in there. Just they're putting things in to put some doubt in their minds as to, did God really mean what Paul said, you know, here, mm-hmm. or something like that, you know,
right.
Which would be right along the same mm-hmm. lines as what the serpent did.
Right.
And then, you know, so, well, he didn't really mean that. He meant this, you
yeah.
know. And,
mm-hmm.
and
or
then,
it's not really that bad.
Yeah.
And those are exactly the things
anywhere.
Yeah, that we saw when we talked about the whole issue of what does the Bible teach about homosexuality, right? What does it really say,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
That's how it always comes along. Or what is it really? What did Paul really mean about women?
Yeah.
And it's that same thing. Well,
yeah.
what, you know, here's what it says. Everyone sees what it says. There's no disagreement. There's the words.
And so they work it into what they want it to say. Really.
But what does it really? What did it really? What did he really mean? Yeah. And there's this whole idea of transforming like a butterfly. You know, you got this little cocoon with a caterpillar, and then out pops this glorious. And I think that's part of what Kevin's talking about, is that these people in this whole work of Satan is simultaneously at its core and its origin just hideously dark. And if you could always see how dark it was, it probably wouldn't be nearly as effective.
Yeah.
But it transforms itself into this really appealing, glorious, good-looking thing, or harmless, but the core is not any different. It's still just as dark. It's still just a caterpillar, you know, the ugly worm down there behind the butterfly. And, you know, I think a lot of that transformation, appeals to people who don't have the biblical worldview. Because when you're out in the culture, you know, a lot of the things that, as Christian, that you see in the culture that are really, they look good to a lot of people, but you can see at the core, you know, it's not. It's not a good-looking thing. It's actually a horrible thing, but it appears that way.
I think the teaching that Christians receive is very, you know, how are they taught, by verse by verse, or are they taught by
topics?
Yeah, topics or whatever. And if they're taught by topics, then invariably things have to be left out. You know, you're never gonna move all those topics in there. And so what happens is, I think you run around, a bunch of Christians are running around not. And I'm not saying for sure, but I don't, because I don't. But they're not getting the totality of the book, and so they're just getting certain parts of it.
One little taproot, and it doesn't have all the other roots around it to anchor it in their heart and mind and all the aspects, and so
it's very easy for somebody to come along and interject something, you know, and they don't really know, and that must be true.
Well, I've been guilty of that, of having a passage that, man, I really want it to say this, but you're forced, if you force yourself to read the context, it doesn't quite mean what you really want it to mean right now, you know, and that, context is very important.
So this word angel, too, in verse 14, the idea there is it's the fundamental, one of the fundamental kind of meanings of the word is messenger. So, he's an angel of light, but, you know, rather than just thinking about an angelic figure like we typically do, I think part of what we want to bring along with that is he's a messenger, because it's tied into the idea of being an apostle. An apostle is a representative with a message. And the representative is delivering a message from one who's greater that sent them. And he's the stand-in from them, kind of like the Pope says he's the vicar of Christ or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. He's vicariously standing in for Christ. So the idea is that Satan is a messenger that looks like it's a light message. Mm-hmm. But it's dark. It's really a dark. Like a good example would be, you know, and again, it comes back to things that we've been talking about. Just the homosexual agenda is a good example. It's like, who could be against two loving individuals that want to nurture each other and support each other for their whole life? They just happen to be two guys or two women. I mean, but isn't that a lovely thing? Mm-hmm. You know, and if you factor out the gender aspect and how God designed things, if you take God's design and his purpose out of it, it might look, you know, well, it's not for me, but, and this is what you hear people say, right? Yeah. The vast majority of people will say this, well, it's not for me, but I'm in support of it. I mean, if they love one another and they're wanting to help each other and be with each other, how could you condemn that? Well, that's the whole aspect where it's taken something that is light, love, helping one another, supporting one another, upholding one another. Those are all good things. But then it gets perverted, twisted. I mean, I don't mean perverted in the way the world talks about perversion, although that's part of it. I mean, it's just taking the design of God, the purpose. Perversion, in my mind, and biblically, I think, is talking about taking something that God has a purpose and a design for, and then using it in a way that's not designed.
Yeah.
So, it's like the way I do construction, right? If I need, there's a nail sticking out and I don't have the right hammer, if I got a wrench, I'll smack it with a wrench.
So you're perverting.
That's perverted construction. And
no, not exactly, but
it is. It is.
So, I don't know whether it goes in straight or not.
But and the reason like me, if I was, you know, preaching on homosexuality or something, I would use the word perversion not as a provocative incendiary word, but in its technical meaning, which the problem with sin and the problem with man and the world is that God isn't just some being out there that's just doing weird things. He has a purpose and a goal. He's moving history. He's made a creation. He made the world. He made man. He made man and woman. He made all of this stuff because he has a purpose and a goal, an accomplishment, a telos, an end, a target. And so all that sin is coming in every case, is sin is coming in and diverting and repurposing, right, and distorting what God, you know, like a good example of sex, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you pick a good example of sex. I mean, that's what we're talking about, homosexual deal too. But even in a regular marriage or pornography or whatever, God has a purpose and a design for it. And that's why Paul spends his time in numerous places saying, you know, the marriage bed is undefiled or whatever. He's saying, look, this is a wonderful thing that God designed for a purpose and to be used in a certain setting with certain restrictions. And within that realm, it accomplishes what God wants, and it's good. It's not dirty, quote-unquote.
Mm-hmm.
But then what man comes in and says, and sin behind it, let's do this in a way that goes beyond what God has prescribed.
The
and perverts it and takes it off. And then a lot of these things that are very powerful things that God has made become very powerfully damaging when they're taken out of the...
Yeah. You know. It's like the greater, the lesser. You know, the greater potential for whatever, as farther it can fall. Like Satan himself, right? He was the greatest created being, and now he's the least greatest.
I think I mentioned it last week, but it enters my mind again here. With you were talking about the loving relationship, you know, between homosexuals or whatever. But as Christians, I think we have to remember the last verse in Romans 1, where it says, if you agree with these people, then you are guilty of it yourself.
Right.
You know, so we have to be careful how we approach these things.
Oh, yeah.
So that we don't say, well, that's okay. You know, I mean,
well, then don't bring in the church.
Yeah, if you guys want to do that, that's okay. Because it's really not okay.
Right.
The whole deal is not okay.
That's right.
As far as whether it's legal or not, it's not legal with God.
Right.
Whether it's legal with the state or the government, whatever, that doesn't even matter.
Right.
It's still not legal.
Yeah. And yeah, we're like the speed, Christians are like the speed limit sign.
Yeah.
You know, we say, this is what God says.
Yeah.
If you want to race by that and get a ticket, you know, we can't stop you.
No.
Right?
Yeah. But we are supposed to say something, because even Christ said, I was going to John 7:7. The world cannot hate you, but it does hate me, because I testify about it that its deeds are evil.
Yeah.
So he blatantly said, that's wrong to the world. That's how, going back to what we said a while back.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and then it says to judge them by their deeds. It's just
Yeah. Yeah. So this transformation thing, you can see it all over the place, right? I mean, a good example is if you know, like talking about the Pope, when the Pope does some sort of a mass, or when they have, you know, all these religious figures that are leaders from these different religious groups together, and they're in their garb, and it's very formal, and it's a beautiful place, and it just appeals to the flesh like nobody's business, and you think, wow, look at this wonderful unity between these amazing faiths and the history and the power and stuff they've had, and it's like dark, so dark.
Mm-hmm.
But it looks
like
so appealing.
Like, what Greg was saying on Sunday, you know, with the Mormon and the others, you know, and it's like what you were saying, that then they're a part of that, of their deeds, really.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When you endorse it, yeah. And so he's, you know, he says, that's no big deal. You know, if he was writing it today, maybe, there's no big deal if his ministers also transform themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we need to kind of really wake up. Because sometimes you get the feeling that the only ministers we're willing to figure are the ones that are obviously not transformed. You know what I'm saying? In other words, when he says they transform themselves into ministers of righteousness, he's saying they look like they're good.
Yeah.
They look like they're on.
Yeah.
And there is a section of the church at large that if somebody's close enough to looking Christianese, then, you know, don't touch the Lord's anointed. You're not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And we're not perfect. But what Paul's telling us here is these false apostles have transformed themselves, and they're deceitful, and those, that word transform and deceitful, he's telling us they're not what they look like. They're not what they look like. They're not the ones that are obviously way out wacky flakes.
Yes.
Those aren't really transformed very far.
No.
You know, these are ones that they look, they're more effective in their deceit. Yeah, they're more genuine in their deceit. And so it takes greater discernment to be able to, and one of the ways you really can discern it is, like Sid pointed out, is not always, but they will still say something somewhere that is like somebody who's truly a Christian. It may sound like a small thing, but somebody who's truly a Christian wouldn't say it in a billion years.
It comes your hair up in the back.
Like the cross is insufficient.
Yeah.
You know, for a Christian to use the word cross and insufficient in the same sentence, I mean, you know, there might be a way to construct a sentence where it doesn't imply, but
it's insufficient if you don't believe in the cross.
Yeah.
There you go.
I think what galls me more than anything is people, he knows he can get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the scary part.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like I was watching a show on the historical Jesus. You know, whenever somebody says the historical Jesus,
like from the History Channel kind of show.
Yeah,
they're
hair right there.
Because they're not going to go to the primary reliable witness of who the historical Jesus is, right? They're going to go to all the weird stuff.
Yeah.
But they had this professor on there from Gonzaga, Roman Catholic University in the eastern part of the state. And I think I've mentioned this before, but there they were talking to him on camera, and the same sort of thing like the Pope. He says, you know, we'll never really understand why Jesus failed in his mission.
Same thing.
Yeah.
And as a Christian.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the whole purpose.
Yeah. I mean, you're sitting there on the couch, and you know this guy, well, he's a liberal professor, he's going to give him some goofy ideas, whatever. But then when he just, And he apparently believes it, you know, and he's just right on camera. He's an expert in religion, and he says he's missing like the very most basic core thing about what is the cross, right? And he says, well, we'll really never know why Jesus failed. And I didn't know whether to jump until my head hit the ceiling or to fall over. Just, I can't believe the guy just said that.
Yeah.
And that huge numbers of people are going to that school to get religious upbringing.
But he says it with authority.
Yeah.
If you can say it. You can do a lie with authority, people will believe you. It's just the way it is. A convincing lie.
But it seems like these guys, a lot of times, you know, ultimately, for them to be a false apostle and to be an angel, a messenger of light, like Satan, it's the message that has to be distorted. At some point, you know, if they're such a good deceiver and such a great transformation, and they preach in such a way that it's the accurate gospel, lots of people get saved, and they do that for dozens of years, they're not doing their mission now, right? Mm-hmm. They've got to distort, they have to. There has to be some false representation in there at some point. Maybe not right away, maybe in some ways that aren't visible for a while, but it has to eventually come to surface because that's their calling.
Yeah.
It's in a sense, it's the same calling we have, but in the opposite way. We're here to testify to the truth. And if we don't ever testify in how we live or what we say, then how can people tell what the truth is? And we're not really doing our job. And so these guys are the same sort of thing that, once you've been in the scriptures a while and stuff and been in fellowship, your ear gets tuned more and more to these little subtleties, things people say, people, what they do, or the way they behave that's like definitely counter to the scripture, and you can pick up on it, but somewhere along the line, their mouth, it seems like nine times out of ten, eventually their mouth will give them away. And that's why, when you go out and look at certain leaders in the Christian church, you want to really pay attention when they're in, not when they're in their church. When they're in their church and their pulpit so much, I mean, you pay attention all the time, right? But in the church, they're not necessarily going to spill the beans there because they know, you know, that's, and they're not as motivated to twist things there necessarily. It's when they get out in these other functions, like with meetings with CEOs or government officials, or they get brought to do the prayer for the presidential day of prayer or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, like Rick Warren, I think, in the presidential mm-hmm. day of prayer, he brings up Issa or Isa, which is the Muslim name for their Jesus,
mm.
and it's not our it's Jesus, mm-hmm. but their idea of Jesus is different. He brings that into his Christian prayer to placate mm-hmm. Muslims that are there,
mm.
right? So that little squeak that he put out there, he's going along nicely in his prayer,
mm-hmm.
and then boom, there's this little phrase,
yeah.
little phrase in there,
like a big blast of a horn.
Like a big blast of a horn, if yeah. you're listening and watching, yeah. right? And it's like it. You see a bunch of things there. First off, is why is that in there? And then it's not really the accurate Christian message. It's a picture of Jesus that is not the real Jesus. And what motivated him to do that?
Yeah.
And so, what is his real motive there? Is his real motive to represent Jesus accurately, come hell or high water?
Nope.
Or is it something else? And you have to conclude it's something else. It's something else. And that something else is one of the things behind why that person is as popular as they are. You know, maybe they have a lot of other mm-hmm. things right, but you got to ask yourself, how many people do you know as Christians, just pastors around here and people you hang around with Christians, that would just like roll that little phrase mm-hmm. off their tongue and not think twice about it? I think a lot of people would have trouble
setting.
With it. Yeah, in a big public setting when you're on the radio and millions of people are listening
yeah.
to you.
National stage.
Yeah. I mean, even Rabbi Zacharias, who's really solid, you know, he took a big beating because he wouldn't use the J word in his prayer.
Mm.
You know? And he purposely didn't say Jesus. He said God, 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 God. Yeah, yeah, a lot of people believe in God.
Mm-hmm.
You're a Christian. We want to hear the J word. Why is it called the J word? Why do people hate that name, Jesus? And what would happen if you trotted that name Jesus out into this prayer right now? A lot of people would be offended. A lot of people you think you're reaching would fragment out. And even he caved, you know. And then when I heard him later on the, and I have a lot of regard for him, so this is like maybe
yeah.
the only thing I'd ever criticize him about. But I heard him on the radio, and I about fell out of the car when I heard him. They were interviewing him. He was really angry at all these Christians
yeah.
who had written to him, you know, and said, you know, I was really disappointed that you pulled your punches and you wouldn't say the J word. And he was not taking that input. He was angry about being criticized for that. And then he went on to say, there are times when you purposely lose the battle to win the war.
Hmm.
I'm like, whoa, where's that in Scripture? Where is that idea in Scripture that, you know, Paul, when you're in a certain
yeah.
place, just compromise a little bit, because a little bit later maybe you'll be able to bring the truth, you know? And he went on to say, you know, for evangelistic purposes, there's that E word that comes in all the time too, and it's not like we're anti-evangelistic here, but evangelism lately is being used a lot to justify questionable aspects. And so he went on to justify it to say, well, Christianity is going to lose a hearing. There are people out there who maybe are followers of God, as he put it, that they're not really prepared for Jesus right then in that state.
And he's going to determine that. Not
but you know, I mean, I listen to him a lot too. But that whole thought that you're saying that he said right there, I never heard any of this Jesus stuff. So and
mm-hmm.
about that. But the fact is that God is already the people. We were chosen before the foundation of the world. Somehow the people that are going to be saved are going to be
mm-hmm.
saved.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
we have
yeah.
nothing to do with that.
Right.
And him, by not using the word Jesus, did not subtract
yeah.
or add to the amount of people who are going to be
yeah.
saved.
He's not accomplishing what he thinks he's
saved.
Accomplishing. Right.
Yeah, he's
exactly.
not accomplishing what he
yeah.
what he's
right.
saying there.
Right.
And I'm not even a wit of being as smart as that guy. I mean,
he's a major intellect.
Major,
yeah.
yes.
Yeah, God uses him in amazingly powerful ways. I've heard him teach and talk on different things. It just blew me away. So anyway, it was kind of disappointing to me because I thought, well, he would have, you know, we would have been better off finding some little granny somewhere that couldn't really speak very well and get her up there and ask her, well, who's Jesus to you? You know, it would have been better.
But I have to admit, if I heard him, and I don't even, I've never heard him, I'd have to go, where is he compromised? And I don't know about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in order for him to do
what
he did.
Yeah, I mean, you almost have to believe he compromised in his own life.
Mm-hmm.
He just happened to bring it out. And you can take that and run with it,
mm-hmm.
because you just saw a little piece of who he was.
Right.
There's a whole iceberg underneath the surface there.
Yeah, well, it's a lot like when people said, well, you know, you guys are all upset about Clinton and what went on in his office, you know, but, you know, all that matters is how he runs the state on the world stage, and we're saying, character is character.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're saying, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, but, so there's this whole situation where when you listen to what people say in settings like that, and I have what they don't say or what they say,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I have to believe in his case, you know, he's become really influential, rightly so. He's definitely been used in real powerful ways by God, and he's very, very gifted. But you got to kind of wonder, you know, anytime you as a Christian are put in a really public setting where you have a chance to testify of the specifics of Jesus,
mm-hmm.
and you don't, you gotta say it's a failure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an opportunity you had to get something out there, and you held your punches. You folded your cards. You folded the deck and left the table. You could have won the game.
See, that's like the new Bibles that they're making to not offend the Muslims. You know, leaving the Son of God out and references like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's exactly the same thing. You're making it. It's like a preacher going up and never preaching about hell because he doesn't want to offend anybody that's out there in his congregation or something like that. It's exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that was big. That was big that he did.
It's the fear of man.
Yeah.
Because I mean, if you put him in his closet, he wouldn't have done that. Right,
yeah.
If he was praying the same in the closet, he wouldn't have done that.
I would hope not.
No,
I mean, he puts a doubt in your mind when you hear that.
Yeah.
You don't know.
Yeah, I do think, you know, I think it's difficult for Christians who have big ministries that have real big influential ministries. I mean, there's a lot more pressure to compromise, right? I think you got to conclude that when you hear stuff like that. When you look at Rick Warren, you look at that situation with Robbie Zacharias and others that you could bring up too, where when you sit back and look at it, it's like, well, you know, when we start as a Christian, when we first come to faith, it's just, Lord, save me, and you're just a little podunk, you don't know nothing. And then when you get to a situation like some of these guys do, that they're so influential,
when you have a lot to lose.
You have a lot
when
to
you
lose.
You have nothing. You have nothing to lose.
You just said it. I have a lot to lose.
Yeah, right.
So
exactly.
He claimed all that ministry to himself. I have a lot
or
to lose.
Or even if he feels, let's say he's got a large staff or something, he feels responsible for the staff. Still, it's ultimately I have a lot to lose.
Yeah.
You know, but you can.
Yeah, I think quite often it's a desire to reach people that are unreached. That's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe for the best of motives, you do the
yes. thing. You know, I tend to give him the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
You know, if he's got a track record of solid
mm-hmm.
service,
right.
Yeah.
You know, but the fact that he wouldn't own up to it, like, man, I kind of blew that. You know, so then you can totally forgive him. You know, look, who knows if you were standing in front of 20,000 people.
Yeah, what would I do? I don't
well,
know.
You know,
I'd like to hear him is when he's yapping around the table. That's when I want to hear him. That's when the true person, when you see him who is sitting on a radio station and he can say, well, I'm going to say this, 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 and this, and this, he's good. It's when he's just sitting around a bunch and he's his guard is down, his mouth is open, and that's when he'll put out its true colors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I wasn't even thinking particularly of, you know, bringing her as an example, but it was just one of those cases where we can kind of reveal motives. Our mouths reveal motives. And I think that's a big part of these false apostles is, like he says, you know, he said here that that they wanted to boast in the same sort of, in verse 12, he says, he's going to cut off the opportunity from those who desire an opportunity to be regarded just as we are in the things of which they boast. So he's basically saying, when you boil that down, their motives are different. Their purpose is different. Their motives are different. And that'll come out, because if you take away the things that are supporting their motives, you get rid of the 300,000 people that are listening, or, you know, get rid of the monetary supply coming into your ministry, are you still going to do the same thing?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it going to be different? Submarine just came in.
No, I think it's too. Not just what are you going to lose, but what are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.